Welcome to Authors on Tour Live, a weekly podcast for people who love to hear about books from the authors themselves. Presented by Belco Credit Union. Visit www.belco.org/authors.asp to learn more about how Belco can help you. My name is Darren Fote, and today we are podcasting live from the Tattered Cover Bookstore, one of the premier independent bookstores in the nation, with three locations in the Metro Denver area. You can visit www.authorsontourlive.com for a complete list of upcoming podcasts. Wait a minute, it's time to begin.
Thank you guys for all coming out tonight, and it's been terrific being here in Colorado, and, you know, drove through a snowstorm. I feel like we really got a really great, like, sort of, you know, Colorado experience. It's awesome. And anyway, but thank you for having me here. I've actually never read at the Tattered Cover before, but the interesting thing is that the Tattered Cover has been such a great supporter of my first book that I really wanted to come here, because whenever you look at a heat map, as they call it, you know, of the United States and where my books sell through BookScan or something else, you guys apparently in Colorado, you guys read stuff. It's amazing. It's so cool. I love that about you. I don't know if it's something about the weather, but it's really awesome. So I really wanted to come here and be supportive, because I'm such a big supporter of independent bookstores and also independent culinary stores. So if you have any local stores that sell kitchen supplies, I'm a big fan of them too. So I don't know how many people have read the first book and know much about it. Anybody? Show hands. Okay, a couple people. So I'm going to start out with where I kind of think this book really starts, and where I think really too few stories start with, which is obituaries. And actually, a really other big part of the story starts with canned tuna, which I think is also not as often a genesis of great stories as it should be, frankly. And so I was 22 and living in my mom, like living at home, and I was working, writing obituaries at my hometown newspaper in Sarasota, Florida. And let me tell you right away, writing obituaries in Sarasota, Florida, very busy job. Very busy job. They say that old people live in Miami. Their parents live in Sarasota. So I sometimes had as many as 100 column inches of obituaries every day. I mean, it was really, it kind of dropped right into it and wrote about that. And you know, and it's funny, at the time when you're doing things when you're younger, you never really realize, like, you always think, oh, this job sucks, it's terrible, or whatever you're doing. And you never really realize the impact it has on your later life. But I now realize that writing obituaries in Sarasota, Florida was probably one of the best jobs that I've ever had. Because one of the things we did is we wrote a feature obituary every day on someone. And one of the philosophies of the paper was that we would write about local people and not just celebrities. Because the idea was, who would you miss more if they passed away? Henry Kissinger, the guy who delivered your mail for like 20 years. And so we wrote about people who sold jewelry at fairs, as well as, you know, the world's greatest bareback rider, because we had that whole weird circus thing going on. It was really amazing. And I think still it's amazing that it's one of the only times in my life that anybody will ever laminate my work and put it into their Bible. So I think that it's really remarkable when I look back on it. And it's a really lasting thing. But, you know, if you take away the services and survivors, it's really a feature story when you write, trying to sum up somebody's life. And it's difficult. You know, it's 8 to 12 inches, newspaper column inches, which will soon mean nothing to anyone. It probably doesn't mean that much to people here. But it was a really interesting exercise to go through, to like really think about, you know, people's lives and how do you sum them up? And how do you sum up what they lived and learned and loved in a very short period of time? And so I had no idea as a kid how much impact that would have on me as an adult. And I say kid in the very loose frame that, like, everybody under 30 looks really young to me now. But I remember one day, I'm at my obituary desk in Sarasota writing all my column inches, and I came across the shortest obituary that I had ever seen. And it was for this woman, and her name was Gladys Smith. And it said simply, Gladys Smith, 84, died Saturday at home. She was the wife of the late Harold Smith. And that was it. There were no services. There were no survivors. There were no associations. There was no education. There was no profession. There were no donations in lieu of flowers to give an indication of what she had been interested in. She didn't belong to a church. And I remember thinking, this must be a mistake, because how do you get to be 84 and have nothing to write about? So I called the funeral home and I asked them, and they said, no, that's actually, we talked to their neighbors and that's all we really have in Gladys. And I remember thinking, wow, could that happen to me? That you just think, surely, I'm sure she had maybe a rich life, but it didn't have those sort of quantifiable, sort of outwardly reportable things that you do with your life. And I think it's very easy for that to happen, you know, and it was something as a very ambitious 22-year-old looking around the newsroom, the gray walls and all the people who work there, and many of whom still work there. And I looked down at my desk and there was a gourmet magazine open, and it was open to a page in the back, and it said, study French cuisine in Paris. And it was an ad for the Le Cordon Bleu. And I remember at that moment, I thought, if nothing else happens in my life, I want my obituary to read, she also earned a degree from the Le Cordon Bleu in Paris. And I don't know how much of it was that I really wanted to go to Le Cordon Bleu in Paris, but I thought, wow, if I could really change my life that much, I mean, I wouldn't be living at home writing obituaries in Sarasota. And so I cut that ad out. And I put it up in my cubicle wall. And then the next day, when that very short obituary ran, I cut that out and I put it up in my cubicle too. And I took both that ad and that obituary and I moved them from desk to desk to desk for 15 years to remind me that one day I wanted my obituary to read that way. But of course, life is very complicated and things happen. And I was busy. You know, life gets in the way of the things you really want to do. And so, fortunately, I went on vacation when I was 36. And I just started dating this great new guy who I really loved. And I thought he was awesome. And I took him home to visit my family, which was a big deal. Because when you're 36 and you're unmarried and you bring home your boyfriend to meet your family, like, my mother was even saying things like, you know, not everybody has to get married. There are plenty of smart women who never get married. I mean, she started like cutting up like, you know, things from People magazine and sending them to me of women who are totally happy not being married. I mean, it was this whole, she was giving up on me. So then I brought home my boyfriend and they were all like, yay. So it was great. And I was so crazy about him, but he lived in Seattle. And at that time I lived in London. And so he got on a plane. He went back home. I got on a plane. I went back home. I thought, wow, is there a way maybe I could figure out a way to move to Seattle and be with my new boyfriend? And we'd been friends for a while, but we just started dating. But then I landed in Heathrow Airport and I got a call. And it was my boss's assistant who said, oh, Kathleen, you know, fantastic. I'm so excited that I got you. Right. So it'd be fantastic if you didn't come to the office today. In fact, you know, Gillian, who is my boss, she's waiting for you right now at the Charlotte Street Hotel. So you just go there straight away. Don't go to the office, though. However, you know, just because that would be fantastic. It'd be best for everyone if you didn't go by the office. I don't know about you, but I think it sounds kind of bad, right? I thought, wow, that doesn't seem like a good thing. So I went to the Charlotte Street Hotel and I found out I never had to go to another meeting again because they had actually reorganized me out of my job when I was gone. And And there's a really weird thing to losing your job when you're on vacation. Well, also everybody else knew I'd lost my job, so it's sort of the last to know. And but I really thought, wow, I don't know what to do next. It was so unexpected, and it was such a big part of my identity. I mean, when people asked me what I did, I mean, I gave them my job title. I mean, when they asked me, like, so tell me about yourself, and I would give them my job title. And so I really thought about it and called my new boyfriend, and I told him what happened. And I said, you know, so what this means is I could move to Seattle. I mean, if you want me to move to Seattle. And he said, no. And I thought, oh God. Oh my God. It's the beginning of a Lifetime movie. I've lost my job and my boyfriend in the same day. But then he said, well, because I think what you should do, and I should really actually stress here that I woke him up. It was like 5 o'clock in the morning, because there was this 8-hour time difference from London and Seattle. And I think it was 5 a.m. or something when I actually called him. And he said, well, because I think what you should do is I think you should take all your stuff, and I think you should put it into storage. And I think you should go to the Le Cordon Bleu in Paris. Because I had told him about this obituary and this idea that I had, but I didn't tell very many people because, you know, you can't tell people stuff like that. They remember. And then they say things like, weren't you going to run a marathon? And then you didn't do it. And then it's really embarrassing. And it's like, yeah, I was, I don't know. And so I thought, oh my goodness, this guy who I'm so crazy about is actually using this lifelong dream that I have to turn it against me, to make me not move to Seattle to be with him. I thought, oh my God, this is terrible. So I came up with as many reasons as I could as quickly as possible about why I couldn't move to Seattle or couldn't move to Paris. And so I said, well, I won't have enough money. I mean, it's going to be $25,000 to go to Le Cordon Bleu. I don't have that kind of money. And he said, well, you know, they're going to give you a little severance, and, you know, you have a 401k. I mean, you could sell that, you know, that'd be fine. And I said, well, I don't speak French well enough. I can't speak French well enough, so I can't go. And he said, Kathleen, it's France. They speak French there. I'm sure that you could learn. I mean, obviously people go to France and learn how to speak French. And then the last thing I said was, well, I won't know anyone in Paris, so I can't go. And he said, well, you'll know me. Because if you want me to, I'll go with you. And so he quit his job. We'd only been dating for 6 weeks at that point. And even though I'd already invited him to meet my family, and he rented his new house, and he came to Paris. And so the first book is really about that experience, about, you know, taking a leap, and a leap in a place you never thought you would go. I mean, I think for me, in a lot of ways, that moment of sitting at the obituary desk and thinking I wanted to go to the Le Cordon Bleu was more about an idea that I just wanted to do something different and big. And then I did it. I mean, it was kind of a weird thing. I mean, then all of a sudden I was in France, and I was at Le Cordon Bleu, and then I had this boyfriend, and it was amazing. And it was an even bigger leap in a lot of ways. I mean, it was not just a leap with sort of geography or my profession. I mean, it was this huge emotional leap, and it was amazing. And I thought I would go to Le Cordon Bleu, and the chefs would be so proud of me and impressed because I threw amazing dinner parties. But then I got there and found out I didn't know how to hold a knife correctly. And there were tears. And actually, I think that's the subtitle, is Laughter and Tears. You know, the world's most famous cooking school. So that's really the first book. And it's very much broken down by all the lessons that I had, and every lesson. So very much that book is about being a student. And I've always thought of that as being a student in culinary school. But I think the more that I have more distance from that time, I realize how much it was about being a student in life. And even though I was in my late 30s when I went there, it's amazing how much, when you think you have a handle on things, that you realize you don't really know. So went to Cornhole Blue, wrote my book. It all did well. Everything's great. It's all good. Then I hear from Le Cordon Bleu and they wanted me to come back and go and do this graduation speech at the Le Cordon Bleu in Paris. It was only 2 years later. And I remember thinking, well, 2 years ago or 3 years ago, I didn't even know how to hold a knife right. Like, what am I going to say to these people? I mean, I'm not working as a chef, and people would always ask me. They would come up to me and say, well, you went to culinary school, Kathleen. Where's your restaurant? What are you doing with your degree? And there was a lot of sort of expectations. And I think there was a lot of expectations for me. I mean, I thought, wow, well, just going to Le Cordon Bleu by itself would be enough. But I realized that, I don't know, if you put that much investment in something you're that passionate about, shouldn't you do something with that? So I really agonized over the speech and didn't know what to do. And so I ended up writing speech after speech after speech. And I missed deadline after deadline to give it to the Le Cordon Bleu. Like, first they were like, oh, well, to get it to be translated into French, you have to hit this deadline. I missed that. I missed another one, everything else. And then I was sitting busy up 5 o'clock in the morning one morning trying to work on the speech and among other things. And my husband woke up and he said, you know, I think I'm going to go and join my dad on his golf vacation in Mexico. And it was a little out of the blue because we knew his dad was going on this golf vacation, but we had not planned to go. And Mike said, no, I checked. I got up in the middle of the night. I checked. I can use my miles. I can go down. I'm going to go. And he left like the next day and went on this trip. And he got there half an hour early. And 15 minutes after he got there, he caught his father as his father had a stroke. And the thing he told me before he got on that flight was, he said, I want to go because I think if I don't go, I won't ever see my dad again. So his father passed away a few days later. And, you know, and I don't know. I mean, how many people here have lost somebody very unexpectedly? I mean, you know, it's chaos. You know, I mean, it's just, you suddenly have to, you know, come up with a memorial service, and you have to think about all these things, and you know, it's you have to tell the story again and again and again, like the story you never wanted to tell. You have to tell it over and over again, and you know, there's casseroles and condolence cards, and there's, you know, all the financial stuff and the will, and there's this and that, and it was crazy. And so we finally, everything came together. We're in Spokane, Washington, which is where his father lived. And we had the memorial service. We had a final meeting with the lawyer. We handed everything off. We got on a plane. We had 3 hours to pack. And we got on our flight so I could go to Le Cordon, I could go to Paris to go and deliver the speech at Le Cordon Bleu. And suddenly the speech that I was so worried about, it really seemed pretty meaningless, really, in the big scheme of things. I mean, here I thought, like, wow, this is the biggest thing. And I realized, in perspective, it was almost nothing. And so I looked at the speech that I hadn't even looked at for a while. And I remember thinking, it looked like this really Ponzi speech about, like, oh, well, how you fit into this history of Le Cordon Bleu and blah, 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 and this legacy and all this stuff. And as I was sitting, waiting in the wings, waiting to read the speech, I realized that I couldn't read it. And instead, I folded it up and I went on the stage and I just said, you know, hey, for some reason, you're here and you came from wherever you are. You know, because you're really passionate about cooking and something brought you here. And so, you know, just go find something. Go find something. Use your imagination and use some inspiration and just try to make a difference. Because at the time, I really wasn't that convinced that the universe needed more chefs. I mean, I think there is a lot of things you can do with a culinary degree that don't have anything to do necessarily with cranking all up plates. And so I told him about friends of mine who had I had went to school with, and one of them had actually started a cooking school in Indonesia in Jakarta, and she was teaching women how to work in the culinary industry, which is something that was not traditionally done there. And another friend of mine had used her management skills and background to go to different third world countries where she would actually study things like the food supply and like try to understand like, why is it that, you know, in some places they weren't getting food, even though there seemed to be enough food coming in the country, but it wasn't getting to the people who needed it. And so you don't think about those as very typical culinary jobs, but I think they're just as culinary as anything else. So I did this whole speech, and then I came back to the U.S. and I remember thinking about it and thinking, if I was in that audience, what would I have taken away from that? Like, where would I go? People keep asking me where my restaurant is and why am I not working the hotline somewhere? And which I have to say, like, I'm in my 40s. I'm way too old for that kind of thing, frankly. But I thought about it a lot, and I was actually thinking about it one Tuesday afternoon when I was in this grocery store, and I love grocery stores. I spend a lot of time in them. And I was actually in my local grocery store where near the cantina, I came upon this cart, and this cart was filled with all these boxes. It was box after box after box. And it was things like, you know, scallop potatoes and like those kits that help like tuna helper and, you know, jars of gravy and, you know, packages of stuff. And it was all that stuff that, I kind of looked at it and I remember thinking, wow, this cart is half full and there's no actual food in here. And I thought, this can't possibly be somebody's cart. I mean, how many people here have ever looked in somebody's cart? I mean, like, I'm not like a freak, right? I mean, everybody does it, right? I mean, have you ever looked in somebody's cart and went, really, that much Jell-O? I mean, I don't know. I mean, it's like, or really that much Hi-C? I mean, wow, you know? And so I always look in people's carts. And I think that this particular cart really struck me because I think I was struck by how you could buy that much processed food and have no food. And so I thought then, well, maybe it's not really somebody's cart. Maybe it's just a restacking cart. Like they're just like a restocking, like they're going to put it back up on the shelves, right? And so then as I'm having this thought, a woman came and claimed this cart with her daughter. And she seemed like a completely normal woman. She's in her 30s, had this 11-year-old daughter. I'm not sure her exact age. And I was so struck by it that I actually started to follow them around the store. And I think stalking is probably accurate. I've since talked to people who've told me that in the research world, like in the academic world, this is called action research. Which I've decided to go with because I think stalking seems like it has, I don't know, call me crazy, a negative connotation. So, but I did, I followed her and I actually went through like the pasta area and vinaigrettes and up and down like the frozen food aisles where she bought things I didn't even know existed, like microwavable scrambled eggs and, you know, chicken nuggets are shaped like dinosaur bites and these pretzels are made into pizza. It was all very stuff I didn't know about, right? I didn't know about it because I'm a food writer and I live in what I call the foodie bubble, or used to. And I mean, we believe in things like perfect peaches and smoked duck prosciutto. And like, it's all about local and sustainable. And those are the things that are really important, right? I mean, these are the messages we're really interested in. And so I, even as I was following this woman, I remember thinking, wow, a lot more food writers need to spend a lot more time in the middle aisles of supermarkets. Because this is just watching this woman shop, it's an interesting story by itself. And so I followed her, and then I thought she was on to me. And so I ended up going into the meat department because I figured at some point she'd get hamburger to go with some of her stuff. So I was standing in the meat department, and she came up, and she bought her hamburger, and then she came over, and she just bought this package of chicken, boneless, skinless chicken breasts. And she said to me, gosh, can you believe how expensive boneless chicken breasts are these days? It's just crazy. And she threw them into her cart. And I thought, a moment for me to actually talk to her. So I did. So I talked to her and I said, wow, you know, well, boneless chicken breasts are on sale now. They're only 99 cents a pound. And she just thought that was the craziest thing she ever heard. And so I ended up convincing her to go to the butcher with me. And she ended up having him show her how to cut up this chicken in individual pieces. And I thought that was like, wow, yay, another shopper saved. But that did not actually end up being the case. So I'm going to read just for a second. She looked around. This is with the package of chicken with her in her hand. She looked around, leaned forward, and whispered in a conspiratorial tone, I don't know what to do with the rest of the chicken. I only know how to cook the breast. She shrugged, embarrassed, but thank you. Thank you anyway for your help. As she pushed her cart away, her daughter in tow, I stopped her. I could not let this woman get away without knowing what to do with the rest of her chicken. By chance, this supermarket happened to be carrying the paperback of my first book. I fetched a copy. I flipped to a recipe for braised chicken thighs with mustard and then to one for stock. At first, she didn't believe it was my book. I offered to show her my driver's license. I'm not trying to sell you a book, I assured her. I'm happy to buy it for you. I can't explain it, but I just really want to help you. For the next hour, I led her around the store, making notes in the margins and writing new recipes in the notepad that I always carry in my purse. We discussed why she bought so many boxes and cans, and as we did, I slowly convinced her to clear out most of them from her cart and to replace them with the real food that the box versions attempted to replicate. You know, I can't thank you for all of this. Enough for all this, she said earnestly as we made our way to the checkout, where, as promised, I bought her the book. At first, I just thought you were some crazy person, shocker. But this feels like Wonder Woman helping to stop fix a flat tire. She and her daughter waved an enthusiastic goodbye. I never even got her name. That afternoon stayed with me. It awakened a curiosity that I hadn't even realized I had. Somehow I knew that this encounter was going to change my life. And it did. So what I ended up doing was doing a lot of research, trying to understand, what holds people back from cooking? How did we get to this place? Like, how did we get to a place where people cook from boxes? One of the boxes this woman had in her cart was actually something called pasta parmigiana. And it was, I didn't even know what it was. So I ended up calling this company and I said, what is this supposed to be? And they put me on hold and they said, after a couple of minutes, they came back and said, well, it's supposed to approximate the flavor of pasta that has been tossed with some olive oil and some Parmesan cheese. Does that answer your question? And I thought, no, it doesn't answer my question. There are 28 ingredients. Like, you're kidding me? There were like 28 different things in this box. There were like two different kinds of cornstarch and corn syrup. And there was like, you know, a soybean oil, partially hydrogenated soybean oil and MSG and like all this other stuff. And it was like to replicate three things. That does not answer my question. Why do people buy the box? What happened? How did we become those people who eat out of boxes? And so I started to do a bunch of research. That's my background. I'm a reporter. I mean, I wanted answers. I could not find answers. And so one night we were watching television. We don't watch a lot of television, but we were watching Design to Sell, which is a show on HD. Have you guys ever seen it? HGTV, right? So they go through and they like take this house and they're like, oh, we want to try to sell this house, and they like fix it up and then they sell it. And then right after that, we watched What Not to Wear. And the concept of the two things are the same. I mean, What Not to Wear, what they do is they actually go through people's closets and they look at all their clothes and then they ask them to show them like, oh, what would you wear if you're going to the store? What would you wear if you're going to go for like a job interview? Blah, 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 different things. And then, of course, they bring them out and they're all terrible. And then they, you know, are really catty. And then they give them ideas and then they send them off and they give them $5,000 credit card and do all this stuff, and they follow up with them months later. So Mike and I, and my husband and I, ended up talking about it. If he didn't pick up on it, he is the guy who's the boyfriend who came with me to Paris, because you don't let those guys get away. So we ended up talking about it, and I said, well, I want to do a project where I can go through and I can do this research that I can't seem to find anywhere myself. And part of it was inspired by a quote from this photographer who I know. And she says, you know, you have to give yourself the great assignments because no one will ever give them to you if you wait around for them. And so I ended up deciding to do sort of a culinary What Not to Wear with all these people. So I found a bunch of volunteers through a variety of different ways, who are aged 22 to 61, and they all came from very different backgrounds. Some, like one woman was on food stamps, another woman lived on this mansion on the bay, and they all had like various issues with cooking. But the main thing that they had in common was that they felt uncomfortable in their own kitchens. Not they couldn't cook. I mean, and I think some of the reviews that have been written about the book have been like, oh, they couldn't boil water and they couldn't do that. That's not true. I think they were all kind of very, you know, just they were cooking, but they didn't really know what they were doing. And what I really found was that the missing ingredient with all of them was confidence. And their lack of confidence came from a wide spectrum of reasons. And so I went to their houses and I looked through their fridges and pantries, and actually we went over and had dinner with some friends tonight. And my friend's wife was like, oh my God, you're going through my pantry. And it's terrifying. Like, right? Who wants to, you know what I mean? It's like going through your underwear drawer. Nobody wants to go through like your fridge and your pantry and then to watch you cook. And, you know, it's particularly if it's something you're not confident about. I mean, it is a pretty brave thing for people to be willing to do that. And I talked to them about why they made choices they did and what they ate as kids and all that stuff. And then we did 10 weeks of lessons, and we did lessons on everything from how to use a knife to tasting, because that was a big issue, was about palate, like not trusting your palate. I mean, people would see things like season to taste and they'd be like, to whose taste? I don't know what that means. Or check seasonings, check them for what? I don't know what that means. And I think that, you know, in retrospect, I go back and I look at recipes, because I'm a food writer. I look at recipes I used to write and I see I wrote stuff like that. I think, oh, the shame. I can't believe I wrote that. It's so lazy in food writing. But, or they would make decisions about what they bought based on cost. Like, these tomatoes were cheaper this week, or this, you know, fast food was cheaper this week, or, you know, I'm going to order from the dollar menu, or I'm going to order, you know, or I'm going to buy like this particular frozen meal because you can get four for $10 or whatever. That it was not really about flavor, that it was about cost. And so we ended up doing a lot of things around tasting as well, where we would do things like, say, for instance, make real pasta, or, you know, like pasta Alfredo, like make a real Alfredo sauce, which is pretty straightforward. And then we'd make a box of Alfredo, and it's strikingly different. Like, I mean, I think even the people who were buying it all the time would then, oh, I think this is fine. This is, you know, I buy this and this is great. And some people were like, wow, I'm really not going to sacrifice those calories for something that tastes like this relative to this. Or even like potato buds, you know, like buying, you know, artificial potatoes relative to, you know, real potatoes, that kind of stuff. So we learned how to cut up a whole chicken and navigate the incredibly complex area of the meat department. What's natural? What's organic? What's chuck? I mean, it's confusing. And how to make simple soups and how to simple pasta sauces and all that kind of stuff. And at the end of it, I waited and I went back a few months later to see what stuck. What can you teach people who feel like they're pretty average cooks to change how they really actually cook? I mean, what can you do that's impactful? And I wanted to know that, like, what would stick? And it was intriguing to find out what they took away. I mean, one was knife skills. I mean, just learning how to use a knife. I mean, how many people in this room feel like they really know how to hold a knife and they really feel confident with a knife? With a show of hands. Let the record state, no one raised their hand. And it, actually, this is really common, right? But the interesting thing about this is that we have two full-time, 24-hour networks devoted to food. There's the Food Network and the Cooking Channel. And no one in this room raised their hand and said that they felt like they really knew how to use a knife. I mean, cooking in this country has become a spectator sport. It's like going to watch a magician, where you might watch a magician and you might think, wow, that was awesome. And you clap, but you don't go home and you don't try to like figure out how they did the tricks. And it's very different from when, say, Julia Child was cooking on television. She started in 1962 or something around there. And I think a really big difference is that people would really go home and they would make Julia. I mean, people would watch Julia Child's show and then they would go and they would go to their, you know, store and they'd be like, I want shallots and I want this. I want to make this thing. I want to replicate what she was doing. And I think that a really big difference is that in the early 1960s, we weren't a generation or two away from knowing how to cook. The people watching her show had a fundamental understanding of how to cook. Like, they knew how to hold a knife. They knew how to go to the store. They felt like they could buy a whole chicken. They could buy a whole onion. I mean, I've talked to many people who told me they buy their vegetables frozen because they don't know how to cut them up. Which, I live in the foodie bubble, right? That was a really big surprise to me. It's not surprising to me now. It seems very like, yeah, okay, I get that. I've heard that lots of times from people. And I think that, you know, we all talk about really big ideas in terms of food. I mean, there's a huge thing about taking back kids' lunches, for instance, or local and sustainable produce, and everybody should shop at a farmer's market. And I am completely in support of all those ideas, but I'll also tell you that General Mills sold more Hamburger Helper in the last quarter than they've ever sold. So that message isn't getting out to people. So that's not getting to the people where this woman I met with the boxes was shopping. And I'm thankful to her, because I think she really changed the course of my life as a writer and as somebody who cares about food. Because I really think, you know, there's all this stuff going on with like Occupy Wall Street, and, you know, I'm sure there must be an Occupy Denver because there's Occupy Boulder, right? So we were in Boulder last night. I mean, there's a whole bunch of people occupying Boulder. And so, you know, people are occupying cities. And what I really think is like, you know, you really want to make an impact? Occupy your kitchen. Like, really take your kitchen back. Because if you don't cook, or you can't cook, or you decide you don't have the time to cook or the will to cook, then what you're doing is you put yourself and the people you're responsible for feeding, whether it's your kids or your parents or your partner or your spouse, you put them at the mercy of other people to feed you, which would be okay, except that in our current landscape, that's almost always multinational corporations. From the toaster pastries in the morning to putting lean cuisine, you know, in the microwave at lunch. Oh, this is being recorded. I shouldn't have actually used a real name. What I meant to say was, to that microwavable meal, you know, at lunch, to ordering a pizza from a big chain. I mean, these are not people who care about your health. I mean, they care about profits. I mean, their interests are financial. And, you know, it sounds like a a radical idea, but if you really go back, it's not that long ago that everybody made everything they ate. I mean, it really is something that I think that over the course of a couple, like a generation and a half, really, that there's been a prolonged and very intense period of telling you that cooking is not worth your time or not worth your effort. And that's why we should feed you. And that would be okay, except that they're the same people who told you that Fruit Loops were part of a nutritious breakfast. And so I believe in the power of home cooking. And I think it makes a big difference. I mean, if you think about all the big issues that we're talking about these days with obesity and diabetes and cardiovascular disease and everything else, you know, there isn't a lot of research that's been done in home cooking, but the research that has been done has shows one thing. The more you cook, the less you weigh. And the more you cook at home, unless you're like cooking all, you know, everything from Paula Deen cookbooks, and then all bets are off. But the more you cook, the healthier you are and the better decisions you make around food. And it's hard. I mean, I think that, you know, I really love all the volunteers who are in my book, and they have done remarkable jobs in terms of where they were and where they came from. One of the original women, one of the women in the book, when I first went to go visit her house, everything was frozen. Everything she ate was like frozen meals, and she ate all fast food. And so when I went to people's house, just like what not to wear, I'd ask them to make something that they made all the time. And so she made me one of her go-to meals, and it was microwavable lasagna with what she called white trash garlic bread. Which consisted of hamburger buns that were spread with margarine and then topped with Parmesan cheese and a little bit of generic garlic salt that she broiled in the oven. And that was the most cooking she knew how to do. That's the only thing she said her mother ever really taught her how to make. And so when I went back only a few months later, she made this great casserole. It was actually delicious. It was amazing. It was roasted cauliflower with like broccoli and like cheese and potatoes. And I think some bacon or something, which she actually had modeled after some like another thing she'd bought when it was frozen. She said, you know, it's amazing. I actually used to buy this in a box, but I found out that like for the cost of two boxes, I could make 12 servings. It tastes way better. And you know what? This is so crazy. I go through and I take the leftovers and I put them in individual servings in my freezer, and it's like convenience food, but you make it. Like, it was so crazy. It's the most amazing thing. And she actually stopped eating, you know, fast food. And she even said, I don't go down the frozen food aisle looking for dinner anymore. And the most recent thing is she and her boyfriend want to start a food truck. So, I mean, it's quite a 180. I mean, because before she was just like, I don't like cooking. I think it's dumb and blah, 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 whatever. But one of the women, and this last thing, and I'm going to end on reading this one section, but one of the women of the volunteers, her husband was the one who cooked when they got married. And what I thought was one of those youthful embraces of, you know, when you get married, she's like, so we made this idea that for the rest of our lives, that he would cook dinner and that I would do the laundry. Because of course you can make those kind of contracts when you're like 22 or 23. And so, but he had lost 90 pounds before they got married. And in the 2 years since they'd been married, she was now 25, he gained it all back. And a big part of it was because he wouldn't eat all day, and they would come home and then he would eat all this like frozen stuff and lots of pizzas and that kind of thing. And so she realized that she was really relying on him to feed her. And so I guess it's, you know, when I say you're relying on other people to feed you, it's not necessarily companies or anything. It's like, you know, sometimes you're relying on actually other people. And so she had struggled so much with her weight. She was at the time about 50 pounds overweight, and she'd gone through Weight Watchers, and she'd really tried really hard. I mean, she could cite the points for everything, and she's adorable. This really one, she still is adorable, amazing person. But she realized that you know, when she entered into this idea with her husband, that she hadn't really thought a lot of it through in terms of the choices he made and what he was willing to cook every night. So this is actually the follow-up. So this is a year after our study ended. Of all the volunteers, I was the most intrigued by Donna. I genuinely liked her and was sympathetic to the power struggle over food and cooking in her new marriage. We never managed a date for a second home visit. After a few months, I sensed that the project had had no lasting effect on her, and she was simply too polite to let me down. Finally, a year after the project ended, we caught up on the phone. "Honestly, I didn't change my lifestyle that much after the classes," she started, my initial suspicions confirmed. "But there's one phase that repeats in my head, even to this day. When you were at my house, you said, 'Do you ever wonder what they do to food to make them low fat?' I guess I never cared about it before. Crappy food had always been a fact of life, but then I started questioning things, although I guess nothing much else changed." Then, a few months earlier, she had started to cook on Sundays. "I'm not sure how it started, but I just decided that Sunday was the only real time that I have to cook." She made 3 or 4 meals and then wrapped them up in individual servings to eat for lunch and dinner throughout the week. She favored vegetable-centric dishes that packed well. Vegetarian chili was a standard in her rotation. In the 3 months since she started, she lost more than 10 pounds. "After years of trying to find the secret to battling my weight issues, I seem to have found it, and it turns out it's in cooking," she said. "I'm an emotional eater, so taking my food with me to work and eating the same things has helped me maintain that food is fuel and that it's not luxury and it's definitely not a reward." She doesn't come home ravenous anymore. A good thing, because her husband has lost all interest in cooking, a major shift in the original context of their relationship. "He eats mostly frozen food now," she said. "I don't want that for myself, but I just don't want to fight with him about it anymore either," she said, adding that he's still about 90 pounds overweight. "Now, if we eat something homemade, I make it. The thing is that he hasn't changed. I'm the one who's changed." You could hear a surge of independence in her voice. "It's pretty exciting, really." When we first met, her husband selected most of their groceries, but his shopping ethos troubled her. He'd buy 5 heads of lettuce at a warehouse store only to throw away 3 of them. It conflicted with the values from her day job working with an African aid organization. Part of what they do is they help feed kids in Africa. Now she shops for her food, and he shops for his. "So I still buy a lot at the warehouse store because they have good deals," she said. "But now I go with a friend from work. We shop together and then we split it. It's interesting because doing this has helped me save money, but I waste a lot less food. And it's fun too. My friend and I, we trade recipes and we catch up. For fruits and vegetables, she hits a farm stand near her house 2 or 3 times a week. I've been trying to eat organic, too. I'm okay with paying a little more to get something local organic. My husband, he thinks I'm so crazy, but he supports me." As Donna made the same recipes over and over again, she found herself experimenting with them. "I used to follow everything to the letter, and now I'm not a slave to a recipe. I trust my taste more, and I'm getting better at knowing when a dish needs something and what that something might be." As with the other volunteers, small bits of information had had an impact. "I didn't realize that spices expired. I thought they lasted forever. I think it's crazy to make a pasta dish from a package. It's about the same amount of work, and mine tastes so much better." She even made gnocchi from scratch, something I have personally yet to master. "I had a lot of potatoes, and I thought I could probably figure it out. I've done it a few times, and I'm getting really good at it now." Not long ago, she made her mother-in-law's classic white rolls. The first time she tried them, they turned out pretty well. When Donna made them in her mother's house, they burned. "In the past, I would have thought, it's my fault. See, this is proof. This is proof that I can't cook. But this time I thought, oh well, I can make these. It's her oven. This isn't about my ability. I think it's about something bigger in terms of my own self-worth. She credits a chicken with some of her confidence. I'd wanted to roast a chicken, but I always felt so intimidated, she said. A few months ago, she had bought her first whole chicken. She delighted in the sense of victory when it turned out perfectly. Now roast chicken was one of her staples. A week ago, a friend of mine came over and she said, "Wow, look at you. You're an amazing cook." And I thought, "What? What's the big deal? It's just a roast chicken." And then she remembered that not that long ago, it was a big deal. So I've encouraged people around me how to cook. I know that it makes such a difference. Small changes put together can be big enough to change your whole life, she said. I have a friend who always bought her vegetables pre-cut. And when I asked her why, she said it was because she was scared of knives. And I was too before this started. So I showed her how it was done so she could get past her fear. She said, was her greatest lesson. You get so afraid of things and then you do them and you think, what was I so afraid of? You just have to do it. Thanks. So I'm happy to answer a few questions. Anybody has any? Anybody? Yes. So I'm going to repeat, because this is podcast, so I'm going to repeat the question. So she was saying, you know, she knows people who, yeah, you could cook on Sunday, but you can do all these other things like go skiing with your kids. You know, and it's really hard to just say, oh, don't go ski with your kids and go, you know, and stay home all day and cook. But I think the interesting question is that, you know, my parents spent a lot of time with us as kids. And they still cooked everything. Like, I grew up on a farm, and my parents actually had to not only make all the food, they actually had to raise all the food. And both my parents had full-time jobs. I mean, my mother and my father both worked full-time when I was a kid, and they had a farm, and they had to, like, kill the chickens and make bread and do all this stuff. And so I really wonder, it's a really interesting thing about, you know, the concept of sort of time poverty. And I think there are legitimately people who don't have enough time. But I think that there's really a question, too, about sort of where is your priority in time? I mean, one of my friends in Florida said, gosh, I just have no time. I have no time. I'm so busy. My kids are so overscheduled. I'm so busy. I'm so busy. Blah, blah, blah. But she realized that she was taking her kids to soccer practice 4 or 5 times a week. And that, you know, instead of cooking for them, she was spending half an hour every night in a drive-thru getting them a McDonald's. And so she realized that, like, hey, maybe this is not the best use of my time. Maybe it's not the best thing for my kids. I mean, I'm standing watching them play to practice soccer 4 times a week. And so she said, I, you know, started not doing that. Like, I just started, like, figured out that, like, there are other parents who are taking their kids to the same soccer practices. And yes, that meant that I wasn't standing there 2 nights a week or 3 nights a week watching my kids practice soccer. But she said, but I was making dinner, and she was making dinner not only for her kids, but for the other parent or parents who would take her kids to soccer. So, I mean, I think, you know, I don't have kids, so it's a really hard answer. Like, it's easy for me to say, oh, everybody has so much time. But I realize that. I think life is complex, and I think the food environment is complex. And I don't think you should take time away from your family. But then again, you know, cooking with your kids is important. I mean, it's important for your kids to learn how to ski, but the reality is it's probably more important for your kids to know how to feed themselves too. I mean, it's something they do every day. I mean, if you think about, we teach kids Algebra 2. I don't know about you. I never used anything from Algebra 2. Was that really the best use of my time when I was in high school? I don't know. I mean, I think it probably would have been a better use of my time or of my other friends to like learn how to cook. You know, I mean, to learn how to use a knife and to be able to make food from real stuff and to take an eggplant and make it into something or broccoli. So I think it is hard, and I recognize that. I mean, I don't think that everything you make has to be from scratch, and it definitely doesn't have to be organic and local and sustainable and all that other stuff. But I think it's worth thinking about, what do you want in terms of what you want to feed yourself, in terms of nourishing yourself? Because food is ultimately, that's what it's about. It's just about nourishing yourself. Making your body as healthy as possible. And, you know, the healthier you eat, you know, less time you ultimately spend in a doctor's office years down the road. But I mean, I think it's, where do you feel comfortable with that? Somewhere between Tuna Helper and Top Chef. I think that's what's important. I hope that answers that. Right. And they've actually done multiple studies since the 1950s about whether or not making a cake from a box actually saves time. They always say it's somewhere like 3 minutes. It doesn't actually save that much time to make it from a box, but a box has 32 ingredients and cake has 6 or 7, depending, or more, depending on what you make. Carrot cake can have like 12 if it's super delicious. But anyway. So, you had a question too.
I was just wondering, beyond your French school, how do the French cook? Do they, you know, cook fresh food, fresh vegetables? Do they go to the market every day? Comparatively speaking, I guess.
Yeah, so the question was, how do the French cook? I mean, beyond the training I had. And actually, Adam Gopnik, who's a writer for The New Yorker, he has a new book that's out, and it's called The French. I can't remember the exact name of the book. It's something like The French, The Family and Table or something like that. And he really talks about how food is different. Like, it has a different level of importance in the French culture. And even when I was in culinary school, I mean, the French chefs would say, if you want to know the best place to buy something, like, you know, whether, like, if you're after the best cheese or the best duck or the best produce or whatever, you followed the older women who had the carts, who were terrifying, by the way. Man, those people would like run you over like heartbeat. They were really like, they knew what they were on. They were a mission, you know, whatever. And they were, go where they're standing in line, because they knew. And they were willing to wait in line, and they were willing to go there, and they were willing to like spend a little extra money and get the good stuff, because it had a different, and I think it's true in some cultures. I don't think it's just a French culture. I think that's something we have more visibility of, but in different areas and different cultures and different countries, I mean, I think they just place a lot more value around the idea of the table, you know, and around dinner. You know what I mean? Like family we know in France, we were talking about like how kids are so overscheduled in America. And he just said, well, but they would miss dinner. And they just thought that was like, well, I can't think of anything that would be more important than them coming home for dinner. I mean, they must come home for dinner. You know what I mean? It was sort of, and I think it is an interesting question. I mean, you know, I think it's more about an element of priority and what it is you want to remember from those years you have with your kids, which aren't that many really in the big scheme of things. And Laurie David wrote a great book called The Family Dinner. And it's about the importance of spending time with your kids and how do you do that? And it's really interesting. Like, she has things about how to talk to your kids at dinner and like how to get them to talk about their day. 'Cause otherwise you say, how was school? And they go, it was fine. You know, and so instead, like how to engage them in conversation and how to come up with foods that are really, you know, interactive, you know, like and introduce them to different cultures and not just, you know, feed them sort of kid foods and the kid menu. And I think it's valuable. I mean, I think it's important for kids to do something physical, like run around and play soccer. And she said that. I mean, this is actually really her line, but she said, but at the end of the day, the thing they're going to do for the rest of their lives is eat. It's the one thing they're going to do. Like, they may take violin lessons and they may take piano, but they may be 14 and they stop playing the piano, and they may be in their 20s and they never play the violin, but they'll eat for the rest of their lives. And they'll have kids, and they'll feed their kids, and they'll feed their grandkids. And what can you teach people that's more important than how to eat and how to appreciate what you eat? And part of that starts with cooking. So it kind of goes back to your question too. And that really was more of a Laurie David statement than mine. And I recommend that book a lot for people who have kids. I think it's really important. So I have time for one last question, because people are standing up going, there's no clock and I have no watch. I'm sorry. And I'm Irish. I'll just talk. Like, I'll just keep talking. My sister even says, you know, I'm Swedish, which makes me sexy, and I'm Irish, which makes me want to talk about it. So anyway, So I have time for one last question, but I'm happy to answer any questions. You can come up. I'm going to sign books. It's my job. And I'll, you know, and I'm happy to answer any questions you have. We can sit and talk. And, you know, I'm not here all week, but I'm here all night. So anyway, well, thank you guys so much for coming, and I appreciate it. It's snowy, and it's, you know, but I'm really excited to be here. Thank you, Tatter Cover, for bringing me out here, and thanks to all of you. So have a good night. And the last thing I'll say is, you know, be fearless in your kitchen. I know you guys can do it. Thanks.
That's all for tonight's Author on Tour. I'm Darren Fote, and we have been podcasting live from the Tattered Cover Bookstore in Denver, Colorado. Authors on Tour Live has been presented by Belco Credit Union. Belco has been serving members' financial needs since 1936. Visit www.belco.org/authors.asp to learn more about how Belco can help you. Stay pod tuned in the coming weeks for many more authors as we podcast Authors on Tour.